Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of EM Insider with me, your host, Crystal Higgins. Joining me today is Allspring's Derek Irwin, who shares his insights into the current investability of China and why, in some cases, he actually thinks valuations are now more favorable and easier to measure.
If I think about that period, right, so in the 90s, you know, China was really just getting on the radar screen. In fact, back then I was in investment banking, and we did the first Chinese IPO, I believe ever in the US. It was a power company. And I think at that point, it was still kind of not really on the radar screen, very emerging. And probably there were other markets that were perceived as a better opportunity, maybe, you know, to be like Latin America and whatnot. But it was, you know, beginning to rise. And then I remember in, you know, by the early 2000s, really even 5 years later, it was pretty clear that China was going to be, you know, a big deal. But even then, it was sort of buy what China needs, not what China sells. So, you know, buy the commodities and whatnot. And then I remember having a conversation with actually a ski manufacturer that I was covering briefly in the U.S.
Skis,
yeah. And they, it was K2, skis, and they were...
skis.
Skis, yeah. And okay. And they were, you know, very much a U.S. company, right? Their skis were always red, white, and blue, and made in Washington State. And I remember talking to the CFO. He said, we just can't do it anymore. We have to produce in China. And so I think they have, like, they make like 10 skis a year in the U.S. Everything else is in China. And so that was a sense, okay, now really China's ramping up. So for the next kind of decade, it was really China's decade. And I don't think there were points of pessimism. And of course, you always got the, you know, folks who thought China was a Ponzi scheme, but largely speaking, it was not a huge, a period. I think it was a period of great optimism for China. And then kind of 2010 to 2015, was the first sense that, hey, maybe the story's breaking, right? So the global trade was slowing. Chinese competitive advantage was, you know, from a cost standpoint, was diminishing, and China had to go through a transition. It certainly took some stimulus from the government to sort of jumpstart both the real estate and even to a degree the consumer market. We had to see the development of kind of maybe 2014 or so, the real sort of emergence of the digital economy in China, with Tencent and Alibaba coming onto the scene, before China really was a source of, another sort of source of optimism for emerging market investors. So I would say that period was, you know, the last real transition period for China. And to a degree, we're in that now, right? So the digital economy in China is maturing. Certainly the manufacturing story is certainly matured and arguably shrinking. And so we are moving into other structural drivers. And of course, we'd love to see the consumer rise up, and we probably will over time. But it's really more around green technology and some of the other areas where the Chinese government is focused on. And I think that gaining traction from that and seeing, you know, and getting confidence around that new driver coming into place is going to take a while. I mean, China kind of wandered in the wilderness a little bit in 2010 to 2014 or so. And that we may well be in that period, but we then went into a pretty attractive period for Chinese growth and Chinese equities. And I feel like that's where we are now, that kind of valley.
Because this isn't the first time. This is the first time you've been on the podcast, but it's not the first time that we've, you know, spoken or met. And we've spoken about China before, and it's interesting. I think one of the things that you mentioned before is that yes, some clients have inquired around the option of going ex-China. But I want to ask you something, a point that you've raised quite recently about how you're balancing that. I suppose the longer term concerns with near-term opportunities and valuations. Could you go into that into a little bit more detail about that kind of balancing bearing in mind long-term risks.
But yeah, I think,
give us like an idea of what you're focusing on, what you're keeping an eye on.
Sure, sure. I think right now, investors really need to balance two things, right? First, there's no doubt that there's been a very clear capitulation by investors, whether it's overseas fund managers like myself, or even onshore, you know, fund managers and retail investors in China, with regard to Chinese stocks. And that means that a lot of high quality Chinese shares have sold off to you know, very compelling valuations. And that's, I think, despite evidence that we're seeing that the Chinese economy has troughed, or hopefully has troughed, and may well recover into 2024. And so that's on the one hand. And then the second, of course, as you said, you know, there are some long-term, real long-term drags on growth, whether it's demographics, whether it's geopolitics, changes in trade patterns around the world. And certainly, even as we see the Chinese economy recover, it's likely to be a pretty slow process. And along the way, there'll be fits and starts that are liable to scare investors. So we need to navigate those two things. But I think if we can thread the needle there, there's a real opportunity to perform well in China over the next 18, 20 months.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of, would you consider, I suppose, when you say thread the needle, what could you kind of break that down a little bit more? Thread the, what, you know, when it comes to assuaging or comforting, assuring investors that there are available opportunities, I suppose.
Yeah, I think.
How do you go about that?
Really, two things that we've been doing. One is, you know, keeping an eye on valuation and having a realistic sense about what the long term, you know, value or value creation opportunity is for a lot of companies that is sold off. And I think part and parcel with that is really a soup to nuts reevaluation of the fundamental investment case. Right? So I think in 2021, in particular, when we had this regulatory tsunami that came through, and of course, since then, as the economy has remained, kind of in stall speed, it's very important to take a blank sheet of paper and look at the companies that you want to follow, whatever they may be, and maybe while we say the internet companies, from a fresh perspective, and say, okay, here's the investment thesis I had in 2020. It has not just evolved; it has probably changed in fundamental ways. And you need to understand that. And I think what we've found when we've gone through that exercise is that while indeed there have been significant changes at a lot of these companies, the value creation opportunity is still there. And in fact, in many cases, it is incredibly strong. And maybe more focused on long-term profitability, long-term return on invested capital than these models were in 2021, when I think the overwhelming narrative was growth at any cost. And now we're seeing growth, but profitable growth. And from our standpoint as fundamental investors, that's pretty interesting. One, because we like profitable growth. And two, that's actually a little easier to value than the sort of growth at any cost thesis that creates bubbles.
So you're saying that the valuation process, like the task of valuing, the valuation process is easier now?
Well, in some cases.
Than it was.
That's a wild, incredible generalization on my part. But in some cases, right? So if I look at...
Let's sit down. It's okay. We don't mind a wild generalization sometimes. It's okay.
You're talking to the right guy.
They can make life easier. They can make a complicated picture a little bit simpler. Can you give me an example of maybe where one of the... it has become easier?
Sure. I think we look at Alibaba, right?
Okay.
There's a company that everybody really knows and understands. And I think... you know, back in, call it late teens, Alibaba was a story about increasing e-commerce penetration in a wildly competitive market, but large and important market. And so you had to project, you know, how big Alibaba could get in e-commerce, what its competitors would do, what would happen to pricing, et cetera, et cetera. And that's very hard. Meanwhile, Alibaba, as well as companies like Tencent, were the largest venture capital investors in China, right? So they had this huge portfolio of, at that point, largely unlisted companies that they had invested in. That are very hard to value because you just didn't have any real metrics to value them by. And so I think what the market did was they said, well, you know, Alibaba is a great e-commerce player. We think it's got great prospects and we're going to give it a great valuation. And since they're doing so well there, we're going to give a very optimistic valuation around this then venture capital portfolio of private companies. And so valuations became very optimistic in that sense. Now we look at Alibaba in a post-2021 world, and that e-commerce business is actually not nearly as, on the surface, not nearly as interesting, right? It's the e-commerce space is pretty heavily penetrated. We know there's, you know, very large, very significant competitors and whatnot. And so it's not as attractive, and I think folks are a little more negative on evaluation. But we look at a company like Alibaba and recognize that some of the regulatory burdens that came about in 2021 have certainly impacted the long-term growth opportunity, but they've also created walls to make it harder for new e-commerce players to come, right? So the landscape of e-commerce players in China now is probably more stable than it was 5 years ago, but slower growing. That's okay, because it makes it easier for me to conservatively value that side of the business. Meanwhile, they've focused on their other businesses like cloud computing, media, you name it, right? And those have become more mature and now are being spun off into various units that will be and are, as a better disclosure, easier to value. So while, you know, my long-term growth assumptions for the e-commerce business in Alibaba have come down, the overall business is focused on unlocking value and is in many ways more manageable to value than it was even 5 years ago.
When it comes to things that you're keeping an eye on, say the job market, youth unemployment, the housing issue, how closely are you watching it, and how much of a how concerned are you about these things? Are they being overhyped in the media? Not to do down my own, but you know, are these cause for concern from your perspective?
It's really hard to say. I think that I think surely the Western media views the housing market in China through the lens of the scars of 2008, right? The global financial crisis, where there was massive leverage in the system. It sat in the real estate market, the shadow banking system, and it was multiplying that leverage, and it really collapsed like a house of cards. And in China, it superficially looks the same, right? You've got a lot of leverage. You've got this quote unquote shadow banking market.
Well, isn't Evergrande the most indebted firm in the world, or the most indebted property firm in the world?
It is, but you don't have the layers upon layers of systematic debt, right? So if Evergrande goes
bust,
that was the word I was looking for, it's very bad, but it's not as clear that it would be the systemic crisis that, say, the Lehman crisis was. And of course, at the same time, you have a backstop. Most of the banks there are government-owned, and they're easier for the government to inject capital in than maybe they were in the U.S. So I don't want to understate it. I think that the real estate market is, call it 25% of China's GDP. It's incredibly important. It is fragile, and there are pockets of very significant leverage. And so the risk is pretty clear. I just am not sure that it's the same sort of degree that maybe we saw in the U.S., for instance, in 2028.
So much of China's growth was fueled by this sort of meteoric explosion in the property sector.
Yeah, I think that's the catch, right? A lot, right? And in a lot of ways. So, not only was it a huge contributor to China's GDP growth, but is now best case scenario flatline, right? So it will no longer, at least in the near term, contribute to GDP growth in a meaningful way. It created a wealth effect amongst investors and Chinese consumers who own real estate, who were then going out and spending. So it was supporting consumer spending and kind of helping that engine, and arguably, supporting animal spirits for investment in general in China, although that's a little harder case to make. And so it really was important. And so not only does it mean that, but of course it was a huge source of revenue for local governments as well. And so those days are probably behind us. And it probably does suggest that China's not going back to, high rates of growth anytime soon, and just because that huge engine is now idle, at best idle.
Yes. Moving on to say maybe the longer term things that you're interested in. I know that the China block you've mentioned before, including Asia, Middle East, LATAM. Could you talk me a little through about where the opportunities are here and why it's something investors should be looking at?
Yeah, sure. I think here's how I look at the world right now, the emerging world right now.
Brilliant. Give me a view on how you view the whole world.
It's a small area to cover, but here's the emerging market investment case right now is really developing into two broad investment opportunities, right? The first one is the development of structural growth opportunities that can create long-term compounding returns for investors if they continue. That's countries like India, for sure, right? Mexico is probably among those as we see the nearshoring trend gaining steam and that market continuing to grow. Indonesia, from a demographic standpoint, again, benefiting from capital moving out of China into the Southeast Asian neighbors. There are those who think the GCC, Gulf Community, Saudi, is another one, although I think the jury is still a little bit out on that one. And then, interestingly, parts of China, right? So the green economy, biologics, software, domestic-oriented sectors that should do pretty well, create this sort of structural growth opportunity within emerging markets. And then there's sort of the economic normalization, macroeconomic stabilization of parts that we need to see inflation come down, rates come down, maybe growth come back in some areas. And that's like Brazil. It's also Mexico again, right? So Mexico gets the double whammy of structural and probably benefiting from, say, a soft landing with the U.S. And then, interestingly, parts of China, right? So China is kind of split in half there. And I think if you look at the world from that standpoint, you can start thinking about how to allocate capital, maybe in the first instance, for companies you want to hold through volatility, right? Maybe looking for opportunities to buy them at sharp valuations. And then the macro stabilization side, that second bit, looking for companies where they appear to be oversold, and whether it's China or Brazil, and then looking for the sort of economic tailwinds to emerge and create opportunities there.
Okay. Because at the minute you are slightly underweight China.
We are.
And I'm sorry if I'm making you repeat yourself. I feel like I've asked you this three times in three different previous conversations, but what would fundamentally have to change? What's the catalyst for you changing that position?
Yeah, I think...
up or down?
I would say maybe I'll focus on the upside, because I think we're underweight China, but less underweight than probably a lot of investors, frankly. Okay. And I think we are focused on the ultimate improvement in the Chinese economy. So I guess what we're looking for in China, and that what I think they really drive that investment case is, of course, we've seen some signs over the last few months of improving macroeconomic fundamentals. That's good. But I think we also need to see earnings and earnings estimates begin to bottom out. And we continue to see earnings pretty soft through a lot of the Chinese economy. If we can see earnings downgrades, which continue to come through, end and maybe turn into earnings upgrades, that can be a real tailwind. That's probably what we're looking for the most. Our view is looking at earnings from a company from a bottom-up standpoint right now, is that we might start to see that in whether it's Q4 or into Q1 of 2020, the first quarter of 2024. It's hard to say, but I think we may be bottoming out on earnings downgrades, which would be a major tailwind for some of these very, very cheap companies. The other thing we really need to see is consumer confidence and consumer spending.
When you're looking at all the areas that you're overweight, be it, region, sector, what kind of pockets of value are you seeing? Areas that are either very undergone a steep discount, areas that are not being looked at, but should be. What's kind of exciting you at the minute?
Well, I think that, a few things. One, I think that in China, just to back that off, we are focused on some of the very strong consumer-related industries, consumer staples, consumer discretionary in China, where we've seen pretty significant sell-offs and where the valuations are attractive, balanced with some of the more structural growth opportunities, healthcare, software, like I mentioned. So China for us, I think we've figured out that sort of balance between the two. Outside of that, we are overweight. We continue to be overweight in Mexico. Mexico has benefited from its being a neighbor with the U.S., and the U.S. economy has been very strong. And remittances from Mexican workers in the U.S. back to Mexico have supported consumption.
You're saying that it's really enjoying the kind of the riches of the reshoring of global supply chains.
Well, I think that's a significant long-term trend in Mexico. I always worry because it's also a neat story, and sometimes that can create a bit of a theme, and then themes turn into bubbles. But I think it is also a real story. When we speak to companies on the ground in Mexico, it's very clear that inbound investment has picked up. We own a real estate company in Mexico. Speaking to the CEO there, was very clear that he's seeing more and more inquiries from companies in the U.S., in Europe, even from China, to put up manufacturing facilities, warehousing facilities, et cetera, into his properties. So it's a very real trend that's occurring, for sure. It is, I think, long and sustainable. I think it does help support the Mexican investment case. Also, Mexican equities are not terribly expensive. They've done very well recently in the last 18 months or so, but still remain kind of within their long-term trending trading range for Mexican equities. So we're not terribly concerned. And the peso is a currency that is well supported, even in an environment where the U.S. 10-year and the U.S. rates are going up. It's still a pretty attractive currency given very high interest rates in Mexico and falling inflation.
And before I let you go, I was just wondering, and I don't know if this is a bit of a dud to leave things on, but I'm just kind of curious what in your view is the kind of the most common, maybe not misconception is the wrong word, but what is the most common misconception that you have to sort of firefight, or what comes across your table about China?
The big misconception we get is that the sort of dead hand of the government is all-knowing and all-powerful. That's definitely not the case, for good and bad. Right? So the Chinese government, I don't think, has a great handle on how to jumpstart the economy or how to manage the monetary or fiscal stimulus in a way that it probably needs. And so that's a negative. But on the positive, there's a lot of great companies that are continuing to operate, and the Chinese government isn't trying to shut them down. There's no war on capitalism. There's no sort of Xi trying to have a great march backward, right? I think that The Chinese government recognizes that there is a place for private enterprise, maybe more than the headlines might suggest. And I think for long-term investors, those fundamentals will play out in a way that should create value and should allow us to find investment opportunities.
I think that's a good note to leave things on. Derek Irwin, thank you very much. And I hope to have you gone soon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.